Good morning. My name is Thomas, and I am an alcoholic. And by the grace of God, I'm sober today. And by the help of this fellowship, the people in it, and the principles behind it, my sobriety is one day at a time. I came into this fellowship about 8 years ago, and I found the early morning study group, and it met my requirements, which was constant meetings 7 days a week. A fairly large group of people who were studying literature, so it didn't get out of control too often, and the fact that they served reasonable coffee. And I decided to stay with that group, which is... I was counting things up as I was thinking about what I was going to say up here, and with the exception of a couple of things in my life, this is the longest I've ever done anything, was to be in AA. I was 8 years in grade school. I lived some places, but as far as making a commitment and staying with that commitment, I'm very proud to say that I've been able to do it by one day at a time. And I was getting really nervous. It's always easier to make a commitment 2 months in advance, and as you're coming up to that day and you begin to see signs up and people are making announcements and they're saying, "Oh, we're going to see you," and everything else, the fear comes in. And I was talking to a dear friend of mine who came into the program about the same time I did, and I spoke to him on Sunday, and he could see that I was nervous, and he said to me, "It's not for you, Thomas. It's for the people who are out there." And that calmed me down, and I thank Tony for that, because that's exactly what I needed to hear. This isn't for me. Just some biographical notes, I'll get it out of the way. I grew up here. I grew up very close to this area. I was born in Buffalo, New York in 1948, but my family came down here in 1949, so I wasn't even a year old. And we lived in the old Peachtree Guard apartments up on Peachtree Road, which were fairly new at that point. And then our first house was at the corner of Dresden Drive and Buford Highway, which is now a storage center in the back of the Mexican Mall. We then moved over to Belvedere Drive, and then in 1959 we moved to where my mother's current house is, over in right behind Oglethorpe University. So I've been within 4 square miles of this place all of my life. When I've been here in Atlanta, I've lived elsewhere, but it was amazing to come home this time, which was about the year 2000, because Atlanta ain't what Atlanta was when I grew up here, and I was sort of a fish out of water, and I think I acted like a fish out of water, because things had not exactly... I didn't come marching in here with a great band. I came back to Atlanta with my tail between my legs, having lost a marriage, having lost my business connections on the West Coast, and having lost a lot of my own confidence in myself. And so I did sort of odd things around here. I delivered Stakeout for a while, so if any of you folks remember when that was there, I was doing delivery work. I met Larry Klinger, and I lived in his warehouse and sort of ran his used restaurant equipment business. And I'll tell you one thing, if you ever want a dyed-in-the-wool AA experience, work for your sponsor. Because that was something else. And, I went to school here, and I had a normal childhood. I mean, I can't say it was... the population of Georgia in 1950 was 3.5 million people. And in 1960, it was 4.5 million people. And now, I don't know what it is, 12 million or something like that. And what I realized is that the changes that go on in my life are changes that I have to handle, and that they're changes that I handled badly for a long period of my life. I was 54 years old when I came in here. And I'm not going to bore you with a lot of drunkalogue, because, quite frankly, the drunkalogues, there were moments, trust me, there were moments of high drama and high anguish, and I might throw a few stories in there, but for me, the real beauty of what has been happening in my life started 8 years ago, when I was down and out, in a way that I had never been before. When I went to high school, I went to St. Pius, graduated, had a scholarship to Notre Dame University, went to Notre Dame for a year, and it was at Notre Dame that I found alcohol. On a Saturday afternoon, Notre Dame was playing Northwestern. We beat them 54-0, and they brought me home from the smoker in a grocery cart. And it was a glorious fall afternoon, and I thought that I had found everything in the world in that. And I don't know how many beers I had, just a few, because I had never drunk before. But what I discovered there was something which was much more powerful than I thought it was ever going to be. I had episodes during that first year in which I incapacitated myself because I didn't know what the effects of alcohol were. I'd possess, two quarts of cheap wine and decide that since it tasted like soda pop, I might as well drink both of them in half an hour. Didn't work. But I was never in that position of actually being totally and completely dependent upon that, and I thought that I was never in that position until I came in here. After my first year at Notre Dame, I realized that I needed to take some time off. There were things that were happening, alcohol among them, but a lot of things that were going on. So if you remember in 1967, we had this little war going on in Vietnam. And over the door at the church at Notre Dame, it says, God, Country, and Notre Dame. And my family had been in the Second World War, both my father's family and my mother's family. So I decided that, God, Country, and Notre Dame, I'd join the Army. And it was one of those things that I did it in Richmond, Virginia. I was working as a traveling salesman during that summer. And I walked into the place, and they weren't getting a whole lot of enlistees that year. Let's say that they were forcing people by the carloads by the draft. So when I walked into this recruiter and told him that I wanted to join the Army, and he said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, jump out of airplanes. And he says, what else? And I didn't say anything. This man just about did handstands. He says, I think we can do that for you, sir. So I joined the Army in 1967. I went through my basic training, went through infantry training, because that's what I was stuck in, went through my jump school training. And I was training to be Special Forces Green Beret up at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. And I was motivated at that time by patriotism, by youthful exuberance, by the chance to do something. And I didn't realize how serious that decision was until I actually went to Vietnam in 1968. Now, one of the things the Army does is it provides a lot of alcohol, and it provides a lot of opportunities to drink it. And I didn't realize that that was sort of one of the things I was signing up to. When things were tough, or when you got an award, or you were ticked off at something that was going on, you could always go to the officers' club or the enlisted club or the NCO club, and you could lubricate yourself. And I didn't realize that that was part of the processing that I was going through. So, I'd get drunk and come back and do my duty, and I didn't see that there was a particular problem with that. And then when I got to Vietnam, I was with the 101st Airborne Division, which in 1968 was really deeply involved. We had a real war going on, and I wasn't prepared for it. I was not prepared for it. I had been an Eagle Scout. I had been a person out in the woodlands, but I had never been out in the woodlands with a bunch of people trying to kill me. And I think at that point, what happened to me is I kind of broke into two people. I broke into a person who was here, and then I broke into a person who was there. And once again, the alcohol was one of the things that allowed me to glue myself together. It allowed me to take care of things that otherwise I wouldn't be able to take care of. And so when I came back from Vietnam, I continued for another year in the Army. I was with a Special Forces group up at Fort Devens, Massachusetts. But that use, that daily use of alcohol had become something that was absolutely essential to me. I didn't think I had a physical addiction to it. And to tell you the truth, I could go through periods of being away from it and not have any physical withdrawal. But there was always the mental and the spiritual thing that brought me back to the use of it. When I was sad, when I was lonely. And certainly coming back in 1969, there was a tremendous social unrest that was going on here, and it was easier for me to sort of stay apart, not be involved with people, and observe from a bar stool or observe from a distance. And I kept that distance, for a long time, when I came back, I went to Georgia State University, decided that Notre Dame wanted me to take a mental examination, and I said, hell, I'm not crazy. So I went to Georgia State, and I graduated from there with honors, got a fellowship, and I was a Danforth Fellow at Columbia University in New York City. I was a PhD program in history. But once again, that same thing about being a divided person was there. And I could participate, but I'd always participate only to a point at which point I'd pull back again. From there, I went to work in the publishing business. I was a book publisher. I made textbooks, college textbooks. I sold them. And again, the autonomy was that I could do certain things and do them well, but I had the ability to go home or during the summers when there weren't a lot of people and indulge myself in alcohol. And again, it didn't seem different to me. You know, I could tell an alcoholic from a long distance away. I could see him when I was living in New York City. I saw him lying on the sidewalk in the Bowery, you know, or they had thrown up in the subway car, or they were trying to, break into a car or wash the windows when you were coming through the Holland Tunnel. I knew what alcoholics were, and by God, I wasn't one. And I was going to show the whole world that I wasn't one. So as I began my climb through the corporate world, I was always very successful. But I was the sort of person that was successful as a firefighter. I could be put in to put out a problem. But Lord help you if you brought me onto your staff, because then you'd have to deal with me when the problem wasn't there. And I liked that. I liked being a firefighter, because I could go in, do whatever it needed to be, and then pull back out again. After a few years of this, I got close enough to a person, or she got close enough to me, came through my trip flares, my area of concertina wire that I had built around myself, and I married her. And it was beautiful for a period of time. But there, too, that insidiousness of being an alcoholic was directly affecting our marriage. Moments of great beauty and great joy punctuated with moments of fear and rage and anxiety. And when she finally decided that she had had enough of this thing, you know, I was totally baffled. Because most of the time I was a pretty good guy. You know, I paid my taxes, I drove my cars, I was not an out-and-out reprobate. But I was pulling farther and farther away from people that whole time. I was living out in San Francisco during this period of time, and after we had separated, I got some, you know, additional jobs, and finally got what I called my dream job. And I was doing well at it. But I was drinking now on a more or less constant basis. I had a position that was a marketing director. I could get my work done. I'd go in at 6 o'clock in the morning, check out at 3, and since I didn't have a wife to worry about when I came home, I'd hit the bar about 4 o'clock, and then I'd come home about 9. And I didn't, you know, I didn't miss a step. But the whole time, that dependence upon alcohol and that separation from people and that sense that I was somehow different from other people was growing. And it was growing in such a way that even the people who had wanted to have me around didn't want to have me around much longer because I was causing problems. And I didn't know how to stop it. Well, I couldn't find work out on the West Coast, so I moved back here. My mom is still around. She's 88 years old, and I take care of her. And the good Lord provided me with the opportunity to come back to Atlanta, and I was taking care of her. And it was kind of caretaking that I took jobs, as I say. I delivered the meals. I worked menial tasks, but it also, you know, didn't interfere with my drinking. Once I had done everything that needed to be done, I'd go up. I was never a whiskey drinker. When I'd try it, I'd usually drink to such a blackout and such a sickness that I'd stay away from it. But boy, I put down the beer. I put it down. And I remember one time I used to drink up here in Brookhaven, and I considered myself to be a good alcoholic, or I wasn't an alcoholic yet, but a good drinker, because I'd usually give somebody the keys if I felt that I couldn't drive home. So I did that one night, and I walked home from Brookhaven to Oglethorpe University, and I think I fell down 25 times. If it hadn't been for a chain-link fence that goes around Oglethorpe University, which I use as a vertical ladder, you know, this sort of routine, I would never have made it. finally got home, didn't have my keys on me because I had left them at the bar, so I had to break the window in the basement in order to get into my house. And it was that night that I think I prayed for the first time, which I said, God help me. God help me. I don't know what in the world to do about this. It was not my intention to go there. It was not my intention to do the things I had done. But like so many other times, I was there. And I didn't like it. Well, things continued for a little while longer, but unbeknownst to me, my family was observing me. And, they'd come in from time to time, and see how I was taking care of Mom, and, then they'd leave, and I'd go, good, it's back to the good old times. Well, one time they came in, and they said, here's the deal. You got to do something about your drinking, or you can't stay here. And I said, what are you talking about? I don't have a problem. So they said, well, we think you do. And the next day, whether I had a problem or not, the DeKalb County Sheriff's Department took me out of the basement and took me over to the emergency center at DeKalb County to be observed for 24 hours. So whether I thought I had a problem or not, somebody else did. And I can tell you, for a Polish-Irish southerner, to be thrown out of the family is about the worst damn thing that could happen. So here I was. That prayer that I had prayed, God help me, came back, and I didn't expect the help that way. It was kind of like, hey, come on. Yeah, you got my attention. And when I called my brother up that day and I said, well, I'm ready to come back, I think I'm chastened enough, he says, no, until you take care of this problem, you're not coming back here. So that led me to A. I took a halfway house up here, and I remember talking to some of my younger compatriots there that would say, well, you know, you're just an alcoholic. You don't have a problem. And I'd say, well, I'm 54 years old. I've been thrown out by my family. I seem to have a real big problem. But I found this place, too. And I used to spend from the morning until the evening, I went to every one of these meetings. And it wasn't because I liked it at first. I mean, I gritted my teeth, and I did not like to be in AA. But that was the first time I honestly said to myself, I am an alcoholic. All right. Still trying to fight it and figure it out. And it was one day that I was here that I heard the words that were read this evening and that are read at most of our meetings, and that was the promises. And I had never heard anything as clearly in my life as those promises. I had seen what you guys do, and you'd shake hands, and you'd hug each other, and then you'd read those promises. And I read those promises every week, if not every day, you know, that if we're painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we're halfway through, that we are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We'll comprehend the word serenity. And that word serenity, we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. A feeling of usefulness, of uselessness, and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us and suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. When I heard those words, something absolutely opened up inside me, and I said, I want this. Still didn't know how to get it. I mean, I was still so full of questions, it wasn't even funny. And I was full of rage, and I was full of anger, and I didn't like the fact that you people kept talking about God, because I had seen what I thought was the works of God, and I didn't like him very much. You know, I saw experiences and had experiences, you know, 35 years in the past, and I said, you know, there is no God. If he is, he's mean. What I was doing was putting myself in the place of God. You know, what I realize now is that I can speak, and I don't speak about religion. I don't speak about my beliefs. I don't speak about my tenets any more than I speak about sex. You know, I engage in these things, but when we're talking about it, it's between me and the person that I'm involved with. Only because I think that words can be so badly misunderstood. And so what I decided to do here with the help of the people who were around me, I had never seen a group of people loving each other as much as the AA people loved. And they didn't I mean, sure, there's always a person who ticks you off the wrong way or, you know, doesn't respond to you in a meeting and you're saying, wow, I was really great. And they said, well, you really suck, you know. No. It didn't say that suddenly our star was going to rise, you know, to the prominent point in the galaxy. It said that I would find a place that I belonged that was appropriate. And that attitude of gratitude and these stupid sayings that you had, you know, God, I hated those sayings. Because to me, they were simple and they were meaningless. Easy does it. Easy does what? You know, one day at a time. And what I found was all of those things are compacted little bits of wisdom that we can throw around at each other. And for the people who don't know what it is, they might be curious enough to ask. And for the people who do know what it is, that's all we need to say. You know. So I began to say that I was an alcoholic and that by the grace of God, this thing had happened to me, which I didn't think had happened to me. I had to untie a lot of knots in my life. Right? And one of the things that I do is I don't put all of my eggs in one basket. AA has helped me marvelously with my drinking problem. It's helped me with my social problems. It's helped me trust people and speak to other people. But it hasn't helped me with certain other things that I need to go to other help with. And I go to a vets group, and we're all combat vets, and we're all as crazy as you want to think about us. But we hang together because we know what we experienced, which to me is the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's one alcoholic speaking to another alcoholic, and the other person understands you without you having to go through all sorts of defeats or, you know. It's the reason why when I go back and think about the time I went up the wrong way street in San Francisco and almost hit a cable car, that's what drunks do. And everyone was going, well, why did you do that? And I said something like, well, it seemed exciting. I did it because I was drunk. I did it because I didn't know. I mean, I lived in San Francisco, so I was showing these out-of-towners, you know, who were coming for the meeting, that I knew San Francisco like the back of my hand. Yeah, I sure did. Yeah. So, I mean, I've had those moments of absolute impoverishment of spirit, of the dark nights of the soul. You know, and the thing that they told me here, that you told me, and that I believe in honestly, and I try to share with other people is, when I go through my life, I don't have to throw my life away. It is my life. But it's kind of like if I lived on the Gulf Shores and the hurricane hit, I got to rebuild my life right here. I can't move someplace else. So my job in the fourth step was to find out all of the things that were both good and bad about me and get rid of the things that were no longer useful and to find the things that were useful and to rebuild with that. That was the confidence that you people told me. And when I get into my, oh, woe is me, I can't do this or something like that, I was taken back to when I was in the military. When we were in jump school, we all wanted each other to survive because we were so ticked off the black hats, we didn't want anyone to drop out. And they were in our face and they were yelling at us, you're not going to make it. So the guy at the last of the platoon as we were running, if he started to fall out, we'd drag him. And the next day, I might be the person who got dragged. And that's what I felt here. I felt camaraderie. I felt that you people wanted me to make it. Not because of me, but because you want everyone to make it. That was that great, beautiful thing, was that I don't have to compare myself to anyone. You know, I was always comparing myself, finding myself either better than or worse than or different from. You know, I lived a life of isolation. I could get up. I was a good actor. I mean, I could stand in front of people. My business was successful. I was in marketing. I was able to put sales meetings together. But inside, if I didn't have that bottle to crawl to, if I didn't have the fake courage before the meeting in order to loosen me up, or the alcohol at the end of the meeting in order to bring myself down, I didn't function very well. And it was that I began to realize is that I was a thorough alcoholic. Not with that sense of the poor person that I had seen on the Bowery, not with the sense of the person who had lost all of their particular possessions. I was an alcoholic in the deepest sense of the world, where I depended upon it and I defined myself by it. And that scared me when I found that out, because I said, I don't know, you know, what's going to happen here. And it was you folks who said, what's going to happen here if you stay with it is going to be those promises that we read to you at the very beginning. And I found every one of those promises came true. I mean, it was staggering. I love the fact that if I do it one day at a time, I don't have to think too far in the future. And if I've been reasonably good at staying with the principles when I get up in the morning, I don't have a whole lot of stuff to untie in the evening. It's not very dramatic, the life I live. You know, I'm not out there curing polio or, you know, making the dead rise and all those things that I thought, you know, was the good person. But what I find is I'm able to understand people far better than I did before. And that leads me to that second thing, that psychic change. I've been stuck in myself. You know, I didn't know how to get out of it. I'd grown up in a family that was large enough that I knew that other people were around me, but I didn't know how to interact with them. And after my experience in Vietnam and in the Army, I was afraid that other people were going to do something to me. Well, could kill me. I mean, I saw that. It was literal. But what I was able to see was that in interacting with other people, good things took place. If I came to a meeting, it was not for my healing, it was for the healing of another person who was in there. I became a member of a unit, a member of a squad, and I was proud of that unit, and I wasn't the one who was required to do everything. You know, that was that whole lessening of this inflated ego. I wasn't getting as anxious as I was before. People could say things to me, and I didn't turn around and say, "Well, you stupid fool, if you knew me." No. And it was because of these crazy principles. They kept telling me. I have another little card here that was given to me. 730 Group had a fellow by the name of Jeff Cohn. Maybe some of you folks remember him. But Jeff was he was from Columbus, and he had some pretty severe tumors. And when I met Jeff, it was towards the end of his life. He passed away probably 2 years after I'd come in here. But in his honor, they gave a little card that has the principles of AA on it. And it says, "In loving memory of Jeff Cohn," and I still keep this with me. And those principles of honesty and hope and faith and courage, integrity, willingness, humility, brotherly love, discipline, perseverance, awareness of God and service, that sounded an awful lot like the Boy Scouts. And I was a good Boy Scout. And I said, "Well, gee, if I can incorporate some of these things into my life, maybe I've got a chance. Maybe I've got a chance." So what I've been doing for the last 8 years is living in that one day at a time. I am taking care of my mom now, not just, you know, the way I thought it was. I have been reunited with my family. I've seen people go through some really life-changing episodes without resorting to the bottle. I've seen courage, you know. I've seen all of the things that were those grand pie-in-the-sky things that I thought were important, but I've seen them in a context which I can understand, you know. And that has drawn me closer to an understanding of God. God, I had thought that God was in man's image, and so I was trying to judge him or her or it or them or whatever by that standard. And what I realized was that we are in his image, or her image, their image. You know, once again, I'm not going to get into that debate. And that with that, the world is wide open. The world is wide open. It isn't defined by the powers that are out there. Yeah, they got power. But ultimately, when it comes down to me, I am unique. I'm utterly unique. Nobody has lived my life, and I have not lived anyone else's life. But not only am I unique, you are unique. You have a life which is absolutely unlike anyone else's. The common things we have are great. It allows us to talk about it. We have language which we can use, which allows us to share information. But for me, being able to see you not as a threat, not as higher or lower, but as my brother or my sister, is something that came directly out of AA. You know, the people who argue about it and say, "Well, it doesn't do, you know, this, that, and the other thing. Why should you become dependent upon something?" The fact of the matter is that it worked for me, and it seems to work for a whole lot of other people. And out of that welter of things, I guess it is, what I discovered is that other people are more important to my recovery than I ever thought they would be. I thought I could do it by myself. I mean, an airborne Green Beret, we can do anything. We can walk on water, and if we sink, we say we intended to do that. All right? Trust me. It was a secret thing. So we never lived in that world of reality. I've been talking for a long time. I was hoping that Daryl would go through the first reading several more times, you know, to sort of... I love that. And what I realize also is that I don't have to... I'm not in the justification game any longer. And that's what frees me to enjoy each and every day. I don't have to justify my position. If I hold my position and it's based on one of these principles, then I can hold my position with honor, and I can hold my position without any fear of whatever I feared before. But it also means that I'm much more open to what other people see. I don't know everything. I don't think anyone knows everything. I know that everyone doesn't know anything, because you can go on the internet and you can get conflicting ideas every time you change a page. So if the great guru of the internet can't agree with everything, what about us poor people who aren't computers? What it's freed me from is so much of what drove me to drink. I was scared. I was lonely. I was away from things. I had one incident in Vietnam, which I'll bring up. I had what they call rucksack paralysis. We used to carry 120 pounds on our back. Now, I weighed 154 pounds. I looked like a piece of rebar. You know, I had this gigantic sack on the back. And our area of operations was up along the Laotian border. So we were in 5,000 and 6,000 foot mountains with 120 pounds on our back. You know, just getting through the day was survival enough, let alone, you know, if we ran into any of the enemy. But what happens with that amount of weight is it paralyzes your arms. So I was going to go up because I couldn't use my arms. It was kind of a mess. And they were going to fly me out to check this thing out. Well, I was sitting one morning, and I knew that we were going to get a resupply chopper in. And I thought I heard somebody say, well, you know, you're going to wait here with somebody or another, whatever it might be, and we're going to move elsewhere. So I was sitting there having my coffee, and everyone else was saddled up. Sayonara. Well, I was sitting there, and I suddenly realized that there was no one else around me. Everyone had left, and I had been sitting there for half an hour. So I was suddenly stuck in the middle of the jungle with my arms not working, not knowing where in the hell they had gone. And I also knew is that we used to drop ambushes behind us if we went through a particular area. That was the longest 3 hours in my life. I was scared to death because I was all alone. And there were bad guys in that area, too. I was so petrified that I don't think I breathed for that 3 hours until I finally made it back to my unit. And, of course, these guys go, Nernie, where have you been? And it was like, no, God, yes, thank you very much for being here and not shooting me on the trail. And God, and they're going, this guy's nuts. The fact of the matter is that I've had a wonderful life. I wouldn't trade it. Would I do things differently? Probably, but I didn't. I do things differently now, which is the only time that it really counts. Now I try to be open to people, and I try to be the person that I've always wanted to be, which would not have been possible had I been drinking. The things that have happened to me, God is not some sort of an accountant who's laid out all these damn things over here, and he says, okay, at 5:15, you're going to get struck by a cab, and you're going to watch it. I don't believe in that kind of God. And I don't believe him in as a vending machine that I put my prayers in and I get, you know, a nice Coca-Cola out of that thing. I don't know what he is, but he's something really neat. And that's what keeps me going. And the last thing that I'll share with you is something that I try and read again. I try and do these things on a regular basis because, just like going to the morning meetings, I go there because it keeps me in the moment. And it keeps me in contact with the people that are around me. And this one you've heard before. It's called The Prayer for the Grace to Help Others. I didn't realize that it was the official title of it. But we know it is the Prayer to St. Francis, you know, which says, Lord, make me an instrument of your peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Where there is injury, let me sow pardon. Where there is friction, let me sow union. Where there is error, let me sow faith, truth. Where there is doubt, let me sow faith. Where there is despair, let me sow hope. Where there is darkness, let me sow light. Where there is sadness, let me sow joy. O Divine Master, grant that I may not so much seek to be consoled as to console, to be understood as to understand, to be loved as to love. For it is in giving that we receive, in pardoning that we are pardoned, and in dying that we are born to eternal life. I was born to life about 8 years ago. Right? It required changes. It has been a phenomenal journey. It is every day I wake up, and it's a beautiful day. And what I wish that I can give to those who might need a little help or need a little fostering is that if you do the things that this group of people says, it does work. Those promises come true. And I just want to thank all of you. I didn't fall down. I didn't throw up. So I consider I've done a reasonably good job. But thank all of you folks. God bless you. Appreciate it.
But your generosity goes toward this group, supporting this group, and AA is done. So thank you for your gifts. And Thomas, thank you for that gift. And I think I speak for many of us that we received the message. And I've asked Tony to give out the chips. Guess I was surprised too when he asked me to do this. White Shield's sign of surrender, just doing it one day at a time. Would anybody want this chip? Silver is 30 days, 1,000 nights, the hardest 30 days I've ever had. Red, 90 days, the red's out your eyes, and you can finally see what's going on. Would anybody like a 90-day chip? Yellow, 6 months, half of that long year. Anybody got 6 months? The most given out chip, that's what I was told. 9 months, the green chip. The grass is green now. You see where you're going. And I think they also said that the grass is grown back from the path from the liquor store. And the one-year chip, years of multiples, the blue chip. And this is the one you really shoot for because this is the one that brought me out the jungle. Would anybody like a blue chip? Thank God for the chips you have. Okay, it's time for AA announcements. Well, yes. Hey, thank you. That's a good reminder. Next week we've got Clyde N. Been sober since 1975, and I think he was a child prodigy in our group. And it's a pretty colorful story. It's one of the first ones I ever heard coming into the program. And he was born and raised on Cumberland Island, and that's a pretty unique thing in itself. Very few people are. Actually live on Cumberland Island. So He's a very interesting speaker. And then the week after that, Steve L. from 8111. He's a regular at the 8111 pre-dawn busters group, and spoke recently at 8111 and made a big impression on one of the folks that's a big contributor here. And so we are very happy that he accepted our invitation. Okay, there's got to be something. There's still chairs, orange and wine-colored chairs, $5. You can have a little piece of Neva in your home, too. Okay, well, if you're tempted, we can take your money, $5. Okay, so I'd like to remind everybody that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. And for those who will, please join us in the Lord's Prayer. Ed S., would you please take us out?
A moment of silence for those suffering inside and outside of these rooms, followed by the Lord's Prayer. Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Keep coming back if it works as it works.
It works.
Yeah. That's a great meeting, man. That's good.
Thank you, John. All right, thank you. Okay. How are you, my friend? My name is Grayson. I'm Thomas Gray. He's a good speaker. You think he does it? But then, you know, it's a PhD program, I guess. I'm a PhD. I'm piled high and deep. All right. You can share it.
Thank you.
I'm sorry.
No worries.
I saw the notebook, but I didn't.
I'm Tim. I'm John.
Nice to meet you.
I like the speaker tonight.
You're great. Hey, Barbara. Nice to see you. Okay, well, I'm glad y'all came. Hey, we got black chairs. Not every day. We have a breakfast on Saturdays, and then Thursday nights we have dinner. And then we have special functions that they go on downstairs, but it's not, we don't have lunch every day like we used to. Yeah. I don't know why we don't. Seems like it's been almost 3 years. Not quite. I heard. Yeah. I never experienced it.
It was cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know why it's not doing this. It's probably $5. Well, breakfast on Saturday is the best $5 breakfast in town. It is a wonderful breakfast. And we have a lot of meetings all day Saturday, starting at 7:30. And Wednesday 11, I think it's 11:30 on the Saturday. It's like the Senate, you know. A lot of old sobriety. But, really happy to meet you. I don't know. TC. That doesn't mean that he's not. That doesn't mean he's not. Hey, Jim, is there a TC? Do you know a TC?
TC?
Yeah.
TJ comes on Thursday night.
I didn't tell where the bodies are buried.